Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary Kerr, the co-founder and chief content officer of Who What Wear. And this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today on the show, I'm speaking with Laura Modi, the co-founder and CEO of the organic European-style infant formula company, Bobbi. Laura founded Bobbi in 2018 after her own breastfeeding plans didn't go quite as expected. She turned to infant formula but found herself disappointed in the quality of ingredients and lack of options available in the U.S. Determined to create a better option for parents, Laura raised $2.4 million from Silicon Valley investors while pregnant with her second baby, and in 2019, another $4 million in additional seed funding while pregnant with her third child. After a winding journey to launch, filled with many ups and downs, Bobbi launched direct-to-consumer in January of 2021, making it the first infant formula to launch in 5 years and the only one founded by moms. Fittingly, Laura is no stranger to early-stage startups and disrupting traditional markets. In fact, prior to Bobbi, she led operations at Airbnb for more than 5 years, and before that, she worked on the financial team at Google. She's here to bring us through it all, from tech to formula and everything in between. Now, on Second Life, it's Laura Modi. Okay, so Laura, we like to start at the beginning on this podcast. So what did you study in school, and what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
Ooh, that's bringing it way back.
Yeah.
I love it. Back at school, I went to just study business. Part of growing up in an entrepreneurial family, there's just an assumption that you'll kind of fall into that as well. So I majored in marketing and finance, and I loved every part of it.
So right out of school, you worked at your family business, which is a company that makes things like flame-resistant and high-visibility workwear. I have so many questions, but let's start with, there you were responsible for launching the company's website and other digital strategies like managing the online marketing plan and implementing Google AdWords. Tell me about that job and what was your biggest takeaway from that time?
It's so funny to hear you also as a fashion expert talking about flame resistant visibility workwear. Very, very sexy stuff. Fun story. It was the year before, a calendar came out with Kendall Jenner and Cara Delevingne wearing one of the high-vis jackets. And to say it made my father's day was an understatement. So good to see a high-vis jacket on, like, you know, one of the biggest models in the world.
Yeah.
So, I mean, look, the company, kind of the broader name is PPE. And like before 2020, no one knew what PPE was, but a very needed set of clothing and workwear.
Yeah.
And it's been in the family now for over 100 years and very traditional. So when I left college, obviously, tech was blowing up. Selling items online became a thing. It wasn't before. Mm-hmm. It was all brick and mortar. So going into the business to get their platform set up and a basic ad structure, how are you going to let the world know that you exist? Loved it. Loved putting my experience into play for the company. However, I probably wasn't overly passionate about selling workwear, which came to a halt pretty quickly after I got everything implemented and started questioning my next moves.
So let's talk about that. At what point did you think, okay, I need to think about my next step? And how do you walk away from a family business without offending everyone?
Yep, that's also a great question. Well, I think there's something as well about a family business that's been in the family for multiple generations, where in many ways they want you, and I remember my dad being so clear about this, they want you to go out there and get experience in the hopes of bringing that experience back. And again, the world of tech was exploding. So one of the hottest companies at the time was Google.
I believe I've heard of it.
Yeah. And, you know, growing up in the west of Ireland, the idea of, I mean, first, the idea of like moving to America and working for a tech company was just the ultimate dream. And yeah, I decided just to give it a shot and applied. And I mean, just even the interview process alone was some experience.
Can you tell me about it? I'm so curious. Was it difficult? Was it lengthy? Was it weird? Was it what you expected?
It was all of the above. Oh my God. I mean, just the weaving of questions. If you were to make and start selling ice cream on the campus of Berkeley, how would you go about researching how many cones you would sell a year?
Oh my God.
To if you could only listen to one song for the rest of your life when you entered and exit a room, what would that song be? I mean, just very random questions. And at the same time, as you're even in the process of answering them, you yourself are understanding, I get it. This is how they determine not just your skill set fit, which were different types of questions, but your culture fit. And if you would bring an ad to the culture that Google obviously is known so strong for.
That's so wild. Okay, so you applied to work for Google, specifically Google Finance. Can you tell me a little bit about the job you were going for and what you were going to do there?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, even just entering Google, you don't really know what you're going to be handed. You just know you're going to join like a fun ride. And I was assigned to work on the Google Finance product, which is essentially financial information and data and analytics on the stock market.
Was that something you were interested in?
Not at all. It's so funny as well. I mean, I'm thrusted into this. And women in general, when you start to compare women compared to men, they are not investors. And honestly, it's kind of like an old boys club. Mm-hmm. So I was assigned to this product and I was determined to learn this and to get really excited about what the stock market meant. And I got so excited about it because I was staring at the stock market every day. I started day trading on the job as well, which was such a fun experience. And entering the investment world in itself is daunting. There's a learning curve, but I wholeheartedly believe in every ounce in my body that women are definitely the best investors and they just need to get over that.
Why?
Well, I mean, we're just sharper. We can see trends.
Pattern identification is an important piece of it, right?
Huge. I mean, like, no one has a crystal ball. No one can, like, look into the future. But it is. It's all about identifying trends and knowing where things are going. And I do think men in general often get too fixated on what the exact numbers are without looking at what's potentially ahead. Like, I'll never forget walking through the Marina District here in San Francisco. And again, new to the U.S., new to San Francisco. And this was back in 2007 or 2008. And I kept seeing these women wearing these tight pants, but like covered in jewelry and makeup, but they looked like they were going to work out. I was like, what is everyone wearing? And it was Lululemon. And like to say it hit me to see every second person wearing this brand. That was my first moment to dabble in the stock market. And I thought, you know what? I gotta put a little bit of money into this. And I became so obsessed watching it that over the course of the next 4 years, that one stock bet ended up buying me my first house.
Wow.
We just get it. Women get
it. That's incredible.
It was great.
Oh, I love that. Okay, so you are working for Google Finance. Your role evolved, obviously, over the 4 years you were there. What changed? What were you learning? How were you growing? What was it like?
Google is a training camp in so many different ways. I mean, it teaches you everything about how to approach business, to how to be able to engage with people, hold a conversation. And then just even on the creative side, I mean, for a large company to give you the space to constantly think creatively was phenomenal. And, you know, hands down, when I say it was the training ground, I believe that there is no way I would be where I am without having started there. But it was a large company. It was a very large company. One of the things that I had to do, I think it was every month or every second month, I needed to go to New York. Because the engineering team that I worked with were based there. Mm. And, you know, typical corporate budget for what you can stay in. I mean, it was pretty minuscule. And I would stay in an average hotel in New York. And the truth is, I just didn't really enjoy work travel. You find yourself like leaving work late, going back to a hotel, climbing into bed, either finishing work or watching TV, and it's lonely. And it was one trip I'll never forget, like trying to find a hotel. And a colleague said to me, why don't you just book an apartment instead of staying in a hotel? Well, that's very weird. She's like, yeah, there's this platform. It's called Airbed and Breakfast. You can just book someone's apartment. That is so weird and the coolest thing I have ever heard. So first thing I do is call my friends back in Dublin. I said, I've just booked a 2-bed apartment in New York. You're 5 hours away. I'm 5 hours away. We could just meet there and just spend the next week together. So two of my friends get in a flight and they potter over to New York while I'm there for work. And I would come back from work every night and we would cook dinner together. We were in the Soho district and we just thought this was the neatest thing, being able to come back and actually feel like we were living in the city. And it was that trip, as we were like every night talking about how cool this was, I was like, I need to work for this company. I don't know what they're doing. I don't know where this is going to go, but I need to work for Airbed and Breakfast.
I mean, that's like a really incredible way to pick your next job, is to fall in love with a product.
Oh, totally.
So before we get into Airbnb, I'm always curious about what people love about a job and what they don't love and how they know I have done what I need to do at this company. So other than being intrigued by Airbnb, there had to be something else that made you say, okay, I think I've done what I need to do here and it's time to go.
What I loved about Google was I entered the company knowing that some of the smartest minds were coming to work here. And I mean, honestly, I felt like an imposter entering. It's like, how am I the one chosen to be able to work with these people? And you had access and you were in conversation and you were developing products with truly some of the brightest minds in the world. And they invited you into them. They brought you into their circle. You were one of them. And actually, it was also one of the hardest reasons to leave as well. One of the biggest reasons for leaving and getting to a place of like, okay, I've done my job, was there's something in me that says, if you can get to a Friday, if you can get to the end of the Friday, and if you can just like quickly recap in your head, this is what I've accomplished this week. And you can articulate the impact that you've had on your job, on yourself, you know that it's still valuable. But I got to a place after 4 years, and maybe it was also the growth of Google too, where it was hard to start articulating the impact I was having on a weekly basis. It turned into a monthly basis, quarterly basis. And that's hard. I mean, it's hard, especially when you're early in your career, to not see your value and see your impact on a regular basis. So I mean, that was ultimately the reason for leaving. I wanted the energy. I wanted the fire. I wanted to walk home every day knowing I just made a big change today.
So you left and you went to Airbnb. So just for our listeners to paint the picture a little bit here, the year is 2011 and the company Airbnb had only been around for 3 years, but growth was explosive, to put it mildly. So in the months before you joined, the company had just announced their 1 millionth booking on the app. Ashton Kutcher had signed on as a strategic advisor and investor, and Airbnb had raised an additional $112 million in funding. So it's obviously a really exciting time to join, and I'm curious about what those early days were like for you.
Your articulation of what it was like when I joined, I mean, it felt like the complete opposite at the time, because obviously I'm leaving a renowned company like Google. And to hear you describe this, like, yeah, that does sound very attractive. But seriously, another thing that happened at the same time that they raised that money was one of the biggest crises for the company as well. There was a home that got burnt down, essentially destroyed. And it was all over the papers. This company who's just raised money, but yet kind of the trust and safety of the platform was being questioned. And, you know, obviously it's like any startup, there's ups and downs with it. I mean, and yeah, the growth was explosive. You know, I remember joining and even just walking into the building. I mean, the hustle, the bustle, the energy, a lot of young, smart, very passionate travelers who had all joined this company to essentially democratize travel. So when I had initially started, I joined as an operations manager, leading our customer service teams. And customer service was huge at the time. I mean, there was a platform where you had one random stranger who speaks in a different language traveling to another country to stay somewhere else. I mean, the slew of things that could go wrong were just endless. From being locked outside to this was meant to be four bedrooms, there's only two. I mean, you just name it. You can't write the playbook for the types of questions that would have come through that phone. So my job was to come on and help the customer service teams essentially scale, build policies, and just thinking about global expansion. And to kind of paint the picture for how needed it was for us to figure out customer service, when I joined, for every booking that was made on the website, someone would pick up the phone and call us.
Oh, gosh.
So you start to do the math on like, well, how is that sustainable? Because it's expensive to run operations and to provide services for those that are making bookings. So, yeah, you start to see that if we don't fix this, this could be the thing that ends the company. You have to fix the product. You need to address questions. You need to build trust. You need to work with your host to make sure that there's a level of clarity and accuracy to what people are booking. And it took years. And I loved every second of it because just like I said about Google, I would finish every day in those early days at Airbnb seeing the impact I had. And it was just such an adrenaline rush.
So you were there for 5.5 years, during which Airbnb experienced massive international expansion, acquired competitors and other tech companies, and launched tons of new features like experiences. From your perspective, what were some of the standout moments, biggest learnings, or just things that you were most proud of?
One of the things that we had gotten to at Airbnb was the realization that the product was not technology. It was not the physical platform. The product was hosts. I mean, essentially, without hosts, there is no company. They are the product. What they deliver every day, how they prep their homes, how they manage communication, that was everything. And we had this fabulous guru mentor of mine who joined the company, Chip Conley, who came with this hospitality mindset. And one of the things that I had the fortune of being able to shift into was working with him to develop an organization, the Hospitality Org, to start rethinking how we work with hosts. Because if they're the product, then we need to start treating them in ways that they feel more equipped, accountable, appreciated, and essentially being able to deliver the expectations that we're setting forth for our guests. Fabulous experience, and being able to move into building a mini org within a larger company at the time, again, was like getting back to like that startup roots.
So in 2016, you had your first daughter, which obviously changed your life in more ways than one. Tell me about how that transformed the way you viewed your career and sparked the idea for your company.
Yeah. So Mary, my God, you're right. She completely changed my world.
They have the tendency to do that.
They absolutely do. So I had her in 2016 with full expectations of returning to my beloved career, loved my job. I mean, you know, I always knew I'd be a mother, very excited to be a mom, but I also loved my job. And I love my career. Ultimately, I wanted to go back to it and I wanted to keep climbing. But when I had her, I was hit with a shaken confidence around how to feed her. Maybe it's me being an Irish Catholic woman. I just thought I'm going to breastfeed and it's going to be easy and it's going to be beautiful. And all of that jazz that society keeps telling you.
It's what your body is made to do.
Oh, God. All of those one-liners you hear, you know. Then you go in with the assumptions like, great, if my grandmother could do it with 13 children, I will obviously be able to do this.
And I got this.
Yeah, totally. Well, what we hadn't really accounted for was that generations previously weren't living in the same society that we are today. So, I mean, the short of it is I couldn't produce enough breast milk. And I found myself going to a pharmacy at like a ridiculous hour, finding an alternative to feed her. And that alternative was sitting in the middle aisle, cradled between cat food and diapers. And this mm-hmm. was meant to be food.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that stigma, that guilt, the shame, the embarrassment that my body's failing me, I'm failing my daughter in the ability to be able to feed her what is considered liquid gold. And I can't do it. So here I am buying a formula, staring at the back of this product that is just riddled with corn syrup mm-hmm. and other ingredients that, I mean, honestly, even as just a health conscious person myself, I wouldn't be feeding this to myself. And the shift was during maternity leave. It was this mental shift of realizing that something about this industry needs to change. And I just could not get it off my mind.
It's interesting because there's so much messaging around fed is best. It doesn't matter. You just want a baby to eat. But I understand your feeling when you feel like your body isn't doing what you want it to do and the stress and pressure you feel there and then not feeling great about what your options are. It's a very difficult place. And I completely understand how that would stick in your head. So what happened next?
Here I was struggling to be able to breastfeed, but I am combo feeding her at the time, you know, getting out whatever breast milk I'm able to do, still believe, and it's still like the most fabulous natural thing you can give her. But I returned to work and that's when things really came to a halt because now I'm realizing, hold on a second, I've been trying to feed her for 35 hours a week and now I'm expected to go back to work. And when am I expected to get my breast milk out?
Yep.
That's just insane. But I think it was the reality of I'm very fortunate. I work for a company where my maternity leave was probably one of the longest in the country, not in the world. That's a different topic, but in the country. Mm-hmm. And I'm there realizing we live in a nation where there's no national paid leave policy. Women have to get back to work. But yet the same government who tells you, hey, lady, can you please go back to work because we think this is best for the economy? It's also the same government who says, hey, by the way, you should be breastfeeding your child for 6 months exclusively because that's what's best for their health. Hold on. That's a huge conflict.
What is that saying of the world expects you to work like you're not a parent and to parent like you don't work?
I love that. It's exactly that. And it's also being done at a point in time where we are most vulnerable, exhausted. Mm-hmm. Our identity has been completely changed. I mean, like who I was pre-motherhood, I have no clue who that woman was. And you're trying to figure this out. It's just so daunting. So yeah, I'm back at work trying to like reconcile this. And throughout all of this, this is where kind of like my investor hack came back on. I'm researching this formula market going, I, as a mother, I'm basically buying the same formula that I had myself because the market really hasn't changed in the guts of 30 to 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. Science has evolved. Our lifestyle habits has evolved. So why is it that the product we are buying for our children still hasn't seen any change? So it was December of 2017. I go back home to Ireland with my 18-month daughter and my husband, and we were there for Christmas. And I'll never forget being in a little pub in Cork for New Year's. And maybe it was the few drinks on me, God only knows what. And I remember announcing to my friends, I'm going to start an infant formula company. And again, they were like, you're going to what? Because at this point now, Airbnb was growing fast. It was a very hot company. I had grown throughout the company. I really had the dream career. And they could not, well, they couldn't wrap their mind around why I would want to do something with powdered milk. Like, I just don't get it. But I do remember leaving that moment going, okay, I've now announced that I'm going to do this. So I kind of need to do it. And I mean, I got back to the US and I turned to my husband that week and, you know, left my job. I mean, I was determined I was going to do this. And the same week that I decided to get Bobby off the ground, I also found out I was pregnant with my second child.
Oh, goodness.
That was exactly his reaction. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Okay, so let me just get this straight. You quit your job without something else lined up with the plan of starting your own company and with an 18-month-old, and you just found out you were pregnant with your second.
Exactly. Love the chaos.
Wow.
It was mad.
So what happened next?
Well, as a planner, I was like, okay, let's put a plan in place. I was like, Sean, we have 9 months before this baby comes. I'll have a product on the market in no time. Like, let's get this done. But I think the naivety of not coming from the formula industry, let alone the food industry.
Let alone you're a first-time entrepreneur.
First-time entrepreneur. The whole shebang. I mean, all thrown in. And I'm going into this going, yeah, this can't be that hard. It's powdered milk, for God's sake. Like, I'm going to spend $20,000 of our savings and we'll get this off the ground. And set what felt like a very clear plan to get to a place that after 3 months, which we called the end of the first trimester, as you should, to say, by the end of the first trimester, we should know if we can get this company off the ground. So let's just work towards viability for the next 3 months. So for the next 3 months, to get it off the ground, it was finding experts in the industry. It was buying books and like staring at one of the first books I purchased. It is The Human Milk Biochemistry of Infant Formula Manufacturing Technology.
Sexy.
Oh, riveting book. It's these small moments early on when starting a company that actually push you further into having to do it. Because in my mind, mm-hmm. I'm like, if I'm about to spend $200 on a book, I'm in this. Like, there's no turning back. Like, you're in it now. So there was all these like small moments early on, and it got to a place, I mean, essentially at the end of the first trimester, where we had designed a beautiful formulation with these wonderful scientists that I had brought on board. And we are essentially staring at a spreadsheet. There was nothing more than that. And saying like, this is the dream formula. Also like 4 times over budget as well. And now I think the reality was hitting that, well, actually, we need to raise money because there's no way that we'll be able to bring this to market just continuing to self-fund this product. And there began the first fundraising journey to raise money to launch, I mean, one of the first infant formulas in years. And that was daunting in itself because, you know, now I'm waddling around meeting investors heavily pregnant. It looked more like a passion project. They're trying to decipher how serious this is. You know, are you just doing this because you want to see a better formula for this coming baby that's clearly approaching? And yeah, I set out with the goal of raising about $1 million and was very fortunate to get to a place where 2 weeks before having my little one, I ended up closing a round of $2.4 million, which was a huge coup to essentially have this baby and then get back on the bandwagon.
I mean, the pressure, though, of like, okay, it's closed, but now you have to do something with it. And oh, yes, you also have a child already and a newborn. That's a lot.
It was. It was chaos and crazy. And it was all fuel. Every part of it was just like fire to like push you to go further. And to be in a moment where you're now being that kind of PTSD moment of being, you know, sent back to those early days of what it's like to breastfeed because you're in it again, mm-hmm. while you're thinking about how to get this product manufactured. I mean, there's nothing like being the customer.
That's an excellent point. So you raised another $4 million in seed funding. Mm-hmm. All of this is still pre-launch, correct?
So in between, I mean, that's correct. We did a pilot. And we did one pilot between these 2 rounds to get something to market and to see what the reactions were going to be like. And it was after the pilot that we then raised $4 million to work towards getting FDA green light, which would essentially, and what has happened, we are the first national brand infant formula to launch in 5 years.
That's wild. Okay, so what was your strategy when you were pitching and what were you planning on doing with the money?
So when you raise money, you need to be very clear about what your milestones are in bringing in that money. The first round was proof of concept. Essentially, let's get this formulation to a place where we can get a pilot out and we can see how it's landing. The second one was to ultimately get the FDA green light. Now, there's a few big hurdles also doing this. Infant formula is not a product you can just make in your kitchen. And like, whenever I hear these beautiful podcasts and stories of people launching their company and they get to like make their first batch at home, or they're working with like a small mom and pop shop nearby to like develop something and get it to a farmer's market and see what it's like. This is infant formula. There's no such thing as like doing it small. So one of the hardest parts of pitching is you need to demonstrate that you can't just develop this in your kitchen and test it out at a farmer's market. We have to develop this with safety and quality in mind under a large manufacturing group who's been doing this for years, who has a high minimum order that costs millions of dollars and ultimately 2 years. It takes a lot of time. And therein lies the reason why there isn't and why there hasn't been other infant formulas that have launched previous to this. Because you need to have a lot of money and time to be able to get it to market. There's a reason why large companies own this space. And also why most of them are run by men. You know, you're making a breast milk substitute. It's also very emotional. We need to put something out that doesn't just like put out a better product, but addresses the emotional side of this too. A company that thinks about the entire journey. But it was truly watching the fact that it took so much time and money that drove the fire to say, we have to figure out how we break through this. And we're very fortunate that we had investors who came forward and completely agreed. And, you know, were adamant that someone was going to break through and there's no reason it shouldn't be Bobby.
So tell me about that pilot program, what those early days were like and what the launch plan was like.
So we did a pilot, and the pilot was, how quickly can we get something to market and just test to see if people like it? One of the things that we needed to do was manufacture it in a place that would make our product under a budget and quantity that we could afford. And unfortunately, the US really didn't have those options because, a huge shock, there is only one contract manufacturing facility that makes all infant formula here in the US.
What?
It is mind-blowing. I mean, manufacturing wouldn't be, you know, something that the US has put much attention into across many industries, but there is very few places to be able to get infant formula made, one to be exact. And the big titans who own the majority of the market, they're full stack, meaning they make their own products in-house. So the short of it is, we go to Germany. I mean, Germany is the birthplace of quality infant formula. And I thought, this is a dream. I'm going to make my formula here. We're going to bring it back to the US, and then we're going to do a pilot and see how it goes. Sounds simple, a little disruptive, and didn't land that way with the FDA. The word disruptive does not translate from Silicon Valley tech into the world of food, especially baby. So I was acutely aware that if you're manufacturing it outside of the country, you are unable to market it to an infant. So we thought, let's just launch this as a beginning toddler formula. Let's get it into the hands of a few people here in San Francisco and let's see how it lands, because it's important to know if this is going to work. We thought we were geniuses. And we launched a very small pilot here in San Francisco, and it was 10 days into being on the market. We had gotten lots of fabulous press attention as well for launching. And I remember being in a meeting, and my co-founder walks in, and she knocks on the door, and she's looking at me, and like, to paint this picture, I mean, she looks really shocked, and she's holding the phone to her chest. She goes, Laura, the FDA is at the warehouse.
Oh, no.
Why is the FDA at our house? We've only been on the market 10 days. And I kid you not, I think we had only really sold to friends and family, some local folks here in San Francisco, because you can't buy it outside of the city. There hasn't been any reports about, you know, the safety of the product or the integrity of the product. And on top of that, there's a rampant black market for European formula. So I'm thinking,
that is a fact.
Yeah. Like, what is it that we have done that has caught the attention of the FDA? So anyway, getting an Uber, we head down to the warehouse, and two very lovely, and they really were lovely, FDA officials in uniform and their clipboard, essentially doing an audit. They're pulling out the press that we had received on the company. They pull out Fortune and Forbes. And in the press articles, they had highlighted where the press had indicated it was for infants, not toddlers. And they're highlighting these words. And I remember that feeling as they're going through this, going, Yep, I get it. Totally get it. Especially in this kind of an industry, everything from your marketing to how you show up in comms to, you know, some of your subtle winks, you need to be very clear, especially in a regulated product, who it's for. So we had to do a recall of our product.
Wow.
A recall. I mean, I could say that word now 100 times and it doesn't shake me, because you have to get to a place and realize this can't be and it shouldn't be the end of a company. But most companies at our size who would have to do a recall, that is the end. But we handled the recall, which was very small here in San Francisco, with grace and integrity. And we partnered with the FDA to make sure that it was done with all of the standards that they had expected. And as soon as we had wrapped it up, which was all of like 48 hours, we got two of the most fabulous phone calls that completely changed the trajectory of the company. The first phone call was from the only contract manufacturing facility in the US that makes infant formula. They complimented how we did a pilot, how we launched into a market that no one's able to enter. And they turned and they said, the way you've handled the recall in the FDA, on top of the way you launch into the market, we've all decided we want to make your product, the product that you've designed, and under minimums that we know that would suffice coming in as a new company. And it was a game changer.
Wow.
We could now get an FDA regulated product to market with a manufacturing group, because you ultimately need them to have the FDA green light. Total game changer. The next phone call was from an investor who also was kind of watching the show and, again, complimented both our approach, mostly on how we handle the FDA, but was fueled to make sure that we actually got that green light and continue to get to market. So that's when we raised that $4 million. And then we spent the next 15 months with our new manufacturing group getting this product to market.
So 15 months. Mm-hmm. You got everything buttoned up and then officially launched this January. How are things different this time around, and what has the customer response been like?
When you launch a company, especially on the back of a pandemic, there's this feeling of, will anyone come to my party? Like, will anyone come? Will anyone like it? It's very daunting. And the response has been glowing. I mean, in many ways, it's overwhelming to see those that are watching us launch and sending us love letters, because they remember what it was like. They remember the same experience that I talked about earlier, where you're tired and vulnerable and you feel guilty, and there isn't a product out there that speaks to you. We are designed and the only product that is designed to also meet EU nutritional standards. And the ultimate belief is that you shouldn't have to turn to an illegal market to get product that meets your standards. You should be able to get it that meets the safety of FDA requirements on top of the standards that you expect to see in the ingredients. And it's landing. It's really landing. And nothing brings me more joy than seeing these parents just come forward with all these love letters. I mean, it's really beautiful.
I mean, it's legitimately what I was searching for with both of my kids, because I can say as a parent, it is so frustrating that you take all of these precautions when you are pregnant, that you are using pregnancy safe products and lotion and watching exactly what you're eating. And then they come into this world and all of a sudden you're faced with the need to supplement, and you're reading the ingredients and you're like, this goes against everything that I've been working at so hard for the last 10 months. And it's deeply, deeply frustrating. So I'm so excited for the rest of the world.
Thank you for opening up on that. It can be a hard conversation, but yes, 83% of parents are going through it. Just nobody's talking about it. It's like the silent majority. But because it's so stigmatized and it almost has that taboo or dirtiness to it, just people don't want to talk about it.
So you're D2C at the moment, but I'm curious about expansion plans. Can you share what your hopes, dreams, thoughts, and plans are on the matter?
Yeah. I mean, a big reason for choosing direct-to-consumer to begin with, and you know, my personal shopping, like I'm not a subscription person. There's two things that make sense as a subscription company. It's infant formula and wine. It's the most predictable, repeatable purchase. So it just makes sense to be a direct-to-consumer subscription company. You don't need to go out and shop your formula, you know, choose different sizing or colors. It's one product and you just need to make sure you have enough of it on a regular basis. So I set the stage of that because I think like our growth plans, which I'm very excited about, are more about what can we do to think about unique ways to disrupt the way we get product to people and ideally do it with a lens of community in mind. Like you go back to, you know, the Tupperware days back in the 50s and 60s. I mean, I get so excited about the concept of building a community around this brand. What can we do where you can get your product locally and not locally in a big conglomerate supermarket, but get your product locally where you would go buy your other favorite organic baby products? Ones where the new medical community of doulas and lactation consultants and midwives, they're supporting moms in this early postpartum phase, are also the ones that are there helping them support on the additional products that they may need. So growth plans are really thinking about how do we make sure Bobby is in the hands of the people who are truly supporting parents and not just having it sit on any old shelf, because the support is a big piece of it.
And the education piece of it.
Yes. Making a bottle, while it doesn't sound that daunting, I mean, it is. And it's also, you are feeding this to the most precious, fragile thing that you have ever brought into this world. And it is the only thing they're consuming. So you want to know from how you make it, to how you feed it to them, to then, by the way, the biggest question that we end up getting back on is, you wonder what goes in is what comes out. So it's always, is this the right color poop? Is it the right consistency? It smells kind of off. And as a new parent, you have no idea that actually there's about 6 different types of poop phases that your baby's going to see in their first year. So maybe not the product, but you don't know that unless you're educated.
There is so much education around it. So one thing that I really like to ask people who come on the podcast is about mistakes, which obviously we've spoken about a little bit, but I think it's so helpful for people to be honest about mistakes that they've made in their career, whether it's management or execution or planning, whatever it may be. So I'm hoping that you can talk a little bit about a mistake that you've made in your career and what you've learned from it.
There's a lot of tactical things when it comes to mistakes. And even to talk about like, you know, having an FDA recall, a lot of things that happen in business. I mean, there's a mistake every day, every week, but they're tactical things. I think on like the bigger part of this, I think one of the biggest mistakes I had in my career was I went into a lot of the moves I made with the assumption that I was too young. And you say this a lot in your career when you are looking to make certain moves, like, oh, but I'm still very young. I'm still young. You know, I still have a lot to learn. You know, it's now's not the right time. And then you blink and you're too old. It's a very harsh transition. And I look back at all of that time that I would have not made, you know, and I suppose in hindsight, they seemed like big moves, but I was still very calculated. And a lot of that was the assumption that the experience and also how old I am, they kind of go hand in hand and you should follow a certain path. And you're like, you're never too young. Like, what is that? That's stupid. And yeah, I would change that mindset.
So a lot of the people who listen to this podcast are interested in switching lanes in their career, whether that's to start their own business or to change industries, or even just to evolve within their own industry. But something's holding them back. They haven't made that leap. I'm wondering what advice you would give someone who is interested in making that jump, but hasn't quite mustered up the courage or the necessity or whatever they need to make that change.
I'm going to speak to moms specifically on this, because I do think if there's any group out there who are in the hardest position to think about like changing their career, moms specifically are. And the advice I would give is to give yourself digestible milestones in deciding to make that switch. It's very easy to just say, yeah, just take the leap, jump off, you got this. But from A to B, there's a pretty long path in the middle, and you need to give yourself the permission to find ways to get to B without being overwhelmed. Because if I didn't have those milestones in that first year, I mean, yeah, I would have hit my first trimester going, oh, I'm over budget. Let's just pack this up and go back. Rather than just like, my only milestone I need to get to is to have a formulation. Great. Okay. Now what's your next one? And each step gets you closer to the ultimate piece of this. But I way too often hear people speak to the fact that they tried it, but they were trying to hit their end result too quickly.
So my last question is my favorite question, which is, if you could go back in time and give younger Laura a little career advice at any point in your life, what would you say?
I would say, Laura, no one is going to bed thinking about you and your career. No one. You are the only person doing it. I mean, seriously, you own your own career. You own your own trajectory. I think many women have this longing, don't long for that like perfect manager who's going to guide you to your next steps and what that looks like. Younger Laura should have been looking for like the leader that she was inspired to be, and just know that you own your own trajectory. That manager does not go to bed at night thinking about your career at all.
I think that's so true. I always say you need to be the CEO of your own career.
Yeah.
And because like no one cares about it like you do, nor should they.
No.
We shouldn't expect that from people, because they have their own stuff that they're worrying about. So take that ownership and go with it. I love that. Well, Laura, thank you so much. This was fascinating, and I so appreciate your time.
Of course, Hillary. No need to chat.
That was the co-founder and CEO of Bobby, Laura Modi. For more inspiring interviews with women like Laura, head on over to secondlifepod.com, where we have so many more for you to peruse. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. We love seeing you spread the word on social, and now you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We always want to know who you're interested in hearing from on the show, so send in your request to hello@secondlifepod.com, or you can DM us on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr, the show's at Second Life Pod. Our DMs are always open. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.